Good evening. Does everybody have a copy of the precepts, the two? I have extras, so no problem. So our assignment this last week was on the third one, no misusing sexuality, which, as I said last week, is much broader than it sounds. Just reading these two little verses, the self nature is sacred and profound in the truth of no attachment. Not creating a veneer of attachment is called not indulging sexual desire. And then when the three wheels, that's greed, anger, and ignorance, are empty, there's nothing to desire. This is the way of the Buddhas. So one of the, in fact, the very first way that we run into this precept, and like all the others, it is runs through our life from the very beginning to the very end. It's not that we get all better and we do not ever kill again or lie again or misuse our relationship with other. The very first time that this comes into our experience is our relationship with our parents. They're gods to us in the beginning. In every sense, for one thing, they're where we came from. They're also our source, the source of our food and shelter. Everything that we need comes from that one place. And so, as babies and toddlers, and even kindergartners and first graders, we look up to our parents as godlike beings. But at a certain point, we begin to see that, we say in English, they have feet of clay. It's a terrible disappointment. And some kids say at a certain point with high insensitivity, you don't know anything. You don't understand. And it's a blow to the parents, because the parents, of course, have really gotten into it. It's wonderful to be a godlike person and be not only supporting and helping these little children, but also being an object of their devotion. But as you think about it in your life, your devotion changes from one set to another set. And all through our life, we tend to want to project our love, you could say, onto another. It's not that it's bad. It's just a mistake. A mistaken apprehension of what that is. Coben said, "You to have two objects to adore is the basic confusion about this." So that if you begin to worship something, it's very well to stop and examine what that is and where it's coming from. something is recognized in ourself. It's touched in ourself, and we see it out there. And so when we, what do they say, take back the projection, then we are completely face to face with each other. You and the other can be completely face to face because there's nobody else. Sometimes we say to somebody, oh, I'm so glad you're in my world. And of course, you're in that person's world at the same time. Worlds within worlds, our dynamic is so great. But this is why there's that old saying that people misunderstand very much about if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. Don't project on Buddha either without understanding what you're doing. It isn't that we don't do it, but to see how that works. And not create a veneer of devotion, affection, attachment, but to give the whole of oneself to all of it. It's very hard to talk about, really. They say sometimes it's about completing the self. So, I don't know how much thinking you did or attending to this subject all during the week. It's not an easy. It's about desire. It's about self-protection and self-enhancement. How we try to better ourselves in ways that don't work very well. Coben calls this no incorrect desire way. So you can look on it also as a subject about greed and how we live in terms of not being satisfied with what we have and are. Our fate is to meet others. Our being is in meeting others. Meeting, you could say, the other in sort of existential terms. But without having been met and without meeting, it's an incomplete situation. And it's also our deepest longing, the self's deepest longing, to meet and be met.
Once or
there's never a once. It's an always proposition. It's It's once, you could say, but it's always. Because it's changing constantly. Does that answer it? We don't live without desire. Even if we try, it's hopeless.
Can we talk about it in
terms of what?
Things as well as people, you know, my desire for a thing, you know, that's different, you know, would be different from my desire for a person.
Well, it's an interesting question. Is it different?
I saw a clip of some woman who got legally married to the Eiffel Tower, and it was kind of crazy.
I didn't hear about that.
Well,
here it is.
I think, consider yourself fortunate, but since I said something, I think I... But yeah, consider herself... I forgot what kind of something sexual, like object of sexual person.
I'm afraid that's a good example.
I have also watched this. It was interesting because these were the people profiled, at least, were actually abused when young. Oh. And so they formed relationships with chairs and like a bow. And that was how it was visible to the viewers, at least. That's
That's very sad.
Having relationships with
them. Wow.
The people themselves actually, if I remember correctly, or this one particular woman that they were interviewing, she denied that there was any kind of connection with that.
They both denied that there was.
And there was a psychologist that was stringently against defining it in those terms of. It was controversial.
I see.
Even in Paris.
Even in Paris.
She didn't even stop at the Eiffel Tower. She married other things as well. I forgot the other monuments.
She's an objective form.
The Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Julian. It's also very sad. But it's how the mind works. It's we're always longing for some kind of confirmation and support and attachment. And we look for it everywhere. And it's not that we shouldn't be doing that. It's just that we need to know that we're doing that and need to recognize it when we are doing it so that we're not misled and misunderstand. And so we don't get caught in a superficial version of it. But of course, most people do get married to other people and or have long-term attachments with other people. And children return to some kind of respect for their parents usually when they grow up. And so relationships continue and change as life goes on. So in Zen, what Suzuki Roshi said, I like very much, that you find that everybody is Buddha. So instead of picking and choosing, your family is special and you have this special relationship, and you begin to, as you practice and you begin to really look around, you find that indeed the Eiffel Tower is Buddha, and so is your best friend, and so is maybe even the person who gives you a really hard time. That it's all Buddha life and Buddha work that's going on. And it's Buddha itself that's recognizing itself in this way. And that's the fruit of practice, is that recognition. Dan?
I'm just looking through all of them. I'm cheating, I'm reading ahead. But precepts 1 through 10, less number 3, are all choices we make. We can choose to lie, we can choose to steal, we can choose to speak, not speak ill of others, and so on and so forth. But number 3, you don't have a choice about being attracted to other people. It's innate. You don't even know.
No, it's nothing. Don't be attracted to other people. Saying don't misuse it.
But
don't misuse it.
But I'm saying that all the other things that he's you can also choose to do all the other things. All the other things can be used and misused also. Mm-hmm. But number 3, you don't have a choice. What it is that you are choosing to use and misuse is innate. All the other ones. I don't think we have an innate desire to kill things.
But we do kill.
We do kill, but it's not a... It is not our normal human tendency to want to go out and kill things.
It is if you're hungry.
No, it is a desire to eat and not be starving. And a lot of people are vegetarians. A lot of people try to eat less.
Vegetarians pull carrots and eat them, and the carrot screams. So, you know, in the big sense, every one of these is something that we do. We're built to do, you could say. We're programmed to do. Because of the way that we're made and the way that the world is of us, in us. And some people, in terms of killing, you know, are scrupulous about straining the water before they drink it and sweeping the street before they walk on it. And they're still killing. They have to. They're eating rice. They're eating carrots. They're wiping their brow. You know, everything that we do is chaos and destruction for some beings, you know. It has to be that way. And stealing in this sense also, you know, we don't own anything, and everything we take is a form of stealing in a way. So
I'm a little confused about the take on the third precept. You seem to be defining it in terms of relation. I was thinking sex, like the, mm-hmm. you know, how that sometimes could even cloud a true relation. I mean even in I think maybe the attachment in a long-term marriage is a bit different than the kind of attachment that comes with sex. And there's so much so much, it's such a loaded thing. I mean, culture is having ideas about it all the time.
Yes.
I mean, there's so much guilt, shame, derangement from it as well. Like,
yes. Yes. And that's what this word veneer means, a veneer of attachment. That instead of truly cultivating a deep relationship, that we just equip ourselves through many without real commitment. And it's a different relationship without commitment. Very different. And it's easy to get caught in a culture of that. America is good at that. Most cultures have a whole underbelly where it's just sex and no relationship, basically. And then the effort to, especially for the sake of raising children, to connect on a deeper level in order to create a holding space for a family so children can grow up safely. And of course that doesn't work very often. It's very, very difficult to achieve. And it's one of the things that we work hard at. But, and a marriage can have a veneer of attachment also. People get married not only because they're committed, but maybe because it's convenient in some way. It's very complex. I mean, if you go to the library, there are books and books of novels full of stories about all of this. It's wonderful. It's human nature. And some of it's raw and painful, and some of it's wonderful. It's not saying sex is wrong. It's just saying enjoy it. Really enjoy it. Don't pretend. Jane.
So the thing about not receiving sexuality is there's also a very kind of commonsensical morality about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways all of the precepts are meant in that way. And really any religion's help for living. I think there is the commonsensical part of it. But I'm wondering if there's another way of also looking at it at the same time. If what is the error in terms of, you know, this misuse of the energy of sexuality. Then, so far, my understanding of it is maybe a bit too thoughty.
Soggy?
Thoughty.
Oh, thoughty. Yes, thoughty.
A little bit. You know, we try mm-hmm. not to make it so much that, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if there's a sense that what's the error in terms of just experience and living with that energy.
Like all of them, it's about aggrandizing the self, putting the self in the middle, and using the situation for the sake of the self's satisfaction only. Of course we satisfy and support ourselves and cultivate ourselves, but in each one of these, if it's misused, it's misused in the way that it's really misusing oneself. And creating a mistaken understanding about who this is.
So it's like when you say anger happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me getting angry. It's just anger striking through me. And so sexual energy is like that too. Sexual energy is. And it's, I can enjoy it or I can do all sorts of things with it.
Yeah. It's given. It's given with this body. It's a gift. Me too.
Freud talks about sublimation. The all energies are sexual energy.
Yes.
It's what we do with it.
Yes.
Use it to be creative and have great works of art. Be smart, or sublimate into something else.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I don't know enough psychology. I don't totally trust that. It sounds too simple. But. You know, I've read some Freud and some Jung and some Adler, but not enough to really be able to say. It just seems too simplified for how complicated our life is. I know the monks at Abhayagiri and how they live, and they totally practice chastity, but they talk about their sexuality all the time. So they're not even sublimating it. They're just living it out in another way and somehow. And they say, without having sex with any particular person, that they're able to completely to complete every relationship that they have. That they're just really right there for everybody. Instead of choosing one particular person to pour it all out with. It's interesting. Well, as I said last week, it's a powerful subject. It's a wonderful subject. The next one is pretty powerful, too. Next one is no lying. So I will leave you with the question of what is a lie? And how do you know when you've lied? Yes, your nose is getting longer and longer. And if you think you never lie, so cultivate, it's really about right speech. This is one of the ones, this is the first one about right speech. If you sort out the precepts and as you are doing, you can also say that this one and the sixth and the seventh are also about right speech. No speaking of the faults of others and no praising self while abusing others. So remember that these are all about the self and how the self sort of ignorantly takes care of itself in its little package of human being without quite knowing what it's doing. So this is another way to wake up. Another way to manifest truth by discovering how often we lie.
And Jean, what was the question again, please?
What is a lie? What's truth? How do we know we're lying? So it's 8 o'clock. I want to mention something, and that is that I'd like to institute a practice period between the first week of the first Tuesday in July through the session in August. So that's about 6 week period. And I'll talk more about it next week, I guess. But I think most of you know, with a practice period, you can cultivate your practice a little bit more intensely. You can choose something to read that you've always wanted to spend more time on, or you can memorize something, like memorize the Heart Sutra or the Metta Sutra. You can sit more. In fact, you're encouraged to sit as much as you can. And join with the Sangha as much as you can. So it becomes a Sangha support kind of practice and an intensification of the practice, which we then end with the Sesshin in August. So I'll talk more about it, but I wanted to let you know about it now, to sort of begin thinking about what you would like to do. It's always a wonderful opportunity to just sort of pull oneself up and, I don't know, straighten up a little bit.